Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
There are families with students enrolled in state-funded correspondence programs or homeschools who are using their allotment to pay for private school classes.
And that begs the question, is it legal? Well, that's under review. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, June 7th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Anchorage plans to close its main homeless shelter by the end of the month.
We've had a lot of individuals express that they will just begin to camp or stay in places that are not meant for habitation.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Parents, did you know that 1 out of 4 Alaska high school students currently use e-cigarettes? E-cigarettes are easy to use and easy to hide. What teens breathe in and out from e-cigarettes is not safe. It contains cancer-causing chemicals, toxic metals, and nicotine. Nicotine can lead to addiction. It can harm brain development and hurt memory, learning, and attention span. Parents, talk to your teens about vaping. Visit livevapefree at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Quitline.
The State Department of Law is reviewing whether it's legal for Alaska families to use public education funds they receive in the form of homeschooling allotments to pay for private school. That's according to reporting by the Alaska Beacon, which found that some correspondence schools have already been reimbursing families for private school classes under a law enacted in 2014. But as the Beacon also points out, the Alaska Constitution says the state can't pay public funds to any religious or otherwise private educational institution. So there is, in the very least, some confusion, and as the law department looks into the issue, the attorney general has recused himself because his wife is an outspoken proponent of the practice. Alaska Beacon reporter Lisa Fu has been following this, and she joins us now. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Casey.
So tell me about your reporting and where did it lead you?
Okay, so I started looking into this one question. Can families enrolled in a state-funded correspondence program use their allotment to pay for private school classes? Is that legal? I figured the Department of Education and Early Development would be able to answer it, but they couldn't. A spokesperson said the question was currently being reviewed by the Department of Law, and because of that, no one at the Department of Education could speak to it. So then I reached out to the Department of Law. I asked the same question, is this legal? And I got the same reply. I was told it was under review, so no one could speak to it. Right now in our state, there are families with students enrolled in state-funded correspondence programs or homeschools who are using their allotment to pay for private school classes. So families are paying upfront for private school and then asking for a correspondence program for reimbursement.
And I guess we use correspondence school and homeschooling kind of interchangeably here, right? But can you explain more about how correspondence schools work in Alaska? What does this allotment program look like?
Sure. Yeah, you're right, Casey. So in Alaska, correspondence school and homeschool are pretty much synonymous and are used interchangeably. School districts in Alaska can establish state-funded correspondence schools for families who choose to homeschool their children. They're under the school district, so they're public programs. Alaska has about 34 correspondence school programs. And here's how the funding works. Correspondence or homeschool students are funded at 90% of the base amount the state pays per student. That's also known as the BSA. Currently, the BSA is $5,930, so 90% of that. A correspondence school can pass that along to families through an allotment program. How much is passed along is different depending on the homeschool program. I talked to one program that will offer $3,000 for high schoolers and $2,600 for K-8 starting this fall. I talked to another program that offers $4,000 per student. So this allotment, whatever the amount, can be used on educational-related needs of the student, like books, classes, school supplies, technology support, tutoring, music, or other activities.
Lisa, you said there are students enrolled in state-funded homeschool programs who are using their allotment to pay for private school classes. How widespread is this practice?
So I don't know the scope of it. In my reporting so far, I know MATSU Central, which is a homeschool program part of the MATSU Borough School District, has been doing it for 3 years. And Family Partnership Charter School in Anchorage plans to start allowing it in the fall. Since the story ran, I've heard and read about other correspondence programs offering it.
Gotcha. And that has to be secular, as in not religious, right? Why is that?
There's a state statute that the correspondence schools point to, which they say allows this practice. The statute says a family may purchase non-sectarian or non-religious services and materials from a public, private, or religious organization with the student allotment. So the principals I talked to really emphasize the non-religious requirement and say they have a vetting process to determine what private school courses are eligible for reimbursement. That statute language was originally part of Senate Bill 100, which then-Senator Mike Dunleavy, who's now the governor, of course, sponsored in 2014. The bill went through a few committee hearings, but the language eventually passed that year as part of House Bill 278. So that's the statute, but the Alaska Constitution has something to say on the issue as well. That's Article 7, Section 1 of the Alaska Constitution. It says, no money shall be paid for public funds for the direct benefit of any religious or other private educational institution. So there appears to be confusion and further need for legal analysis. And the Department of Education isn't adding any clarity to the confusion until it hears from the Department of Law.
That legal analysis or review by the law department seems to be posing another issue, and that's a potential conflict of interest, right? Explain that to me.
Yeah, I did another story about that. Alaska's Attorney General Treg Taylor is married to Jody Taylor, who's board president of the Alaska Policy Forum. She is a major proponent of using public funds for private school education. And last month, she wrote publicly about her plan to seek up to $8,000 in reimbursements for their two kids attending an Anchorage private school. And, you know, in this op-ed, she also offers instructions for how families can use state-funded correspondence school allotment for classes at private schools. Okay, so Jody Taylor is married to Alaska's Attorney General Treg Taylor. So there was a concern that because his family may financially benefit, that he may have a conflict. Turns out the law department thought the same thing. So after his wife's op-ed was published on multiple websites and blogs, the Attorney General recused himself from all matters involving correspondence school allotments, and then he delegated the review to Deputy Attorney General Corey Mills.
Do we have any idea when this review will be complete?
Mills wasn't able to give any more details of the review or a timeline of when an opinion could come out. She did say whenever an opinion is ready, it would be up to the Department of Education to provide any clarification to school districts.
All right, we will stay tuned. And of course, there's more reporting on this at alaskabeacon.com. That was Alaska Beacon reporter Lisa Fu. Lisa, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Casey.
Anchorage is planning to close its main homeless shelter at the Sullivan Arena by the end of the month. It's part of the city's plan to move out of its pandemic-era response into something more permanent. But it'll likely be months until the new city shelter opens in East Anchorage. The Bronson administration says it has a plan for where people will go this summer, but housing providers worry the plan is incomplete and could lead to a big increase in illegal camping. Alaska Public Media's Lex Trinan reports.
It's a cloudless morning in early June outside of the Sullivan Arena. But Shelter Assistant Director Hannah Ferguson has a lot on her mind. The city officially announced a few days earlier that the hockey arena turned shelter would close down by the end of June.
We had been told of, you know, possibilities, but we had other possibilities that were told to us as well. So it was kind of like, okay, this is real now.
Staff posted flyers announcing the closure around the building and explained what they knew to clients. The shelter has housed more than 300 people each night for most of the past 2 years. Ferguson says she's heard a lot of confusion and frustration from many who don't know where they'll stay next.
So we've had a lot of individuals express that they will just begin to camp or stay in places that are not meant for habitation rather than going anywhere else.
That's worrying a lot of advocates and policymakers right now. The city is planning to open a semi-permanent shelter in East Anchorage that could house up to 150 people, but it won't be ready until November. In the meantime, Anchorage Health Director Joe Geray says the city has a plan and available beds for hotels and apartments that people can start moving into. Geray says it's connecting homeless people to case managers, and two new shelters are opening this month that will open up more than 200 beds.
We're going to offer them a whole, you know, range of options, and if they take the street, that's their decision. No one's being put on the street, though. I want to be clear on that.
Meg Zalatel, the director of the Anchorage Coalition to End Homelessness, says she's not convinced the current plan will have enough rooms for those who need them. And even if it does, she says the city hasn't communicated it well. She says she didn't see it until Alaska Public Media shared it with her on Monday afternoon, despite her repeated requests to city leaders.
What we're really stymied with in this moment is the uncertainty thrown into the system when clients can't access shelter. There's nowhere for someone who is unsheltered to go. And there hasn't been a published transition plan.
Zalatel says if her group had been informed, they could have rounded up beds from different service providers to start moving Sullivan clients systematically. Instead, she worries many people start camping, where they're harder to track down to connect them to things like housing, medical care, and jobs. Social service organizations say they're stretched thin, but they're making progress. Catholic Social Services opened an 80-bed shelter for people with complex medical needs on Monday. CEO Robin Dempsey says the organization has been working with clients at the Sullivan to move them into apartments, but
there's no doubt that we've experienced, you know, low vacancy rates, and so finding apartments has definitely been a struggle.
Housing advocate Roger Branson, who spent months talking with clients at the Sullivan, says he's concerned that the uncertainty could make homeless people in and out of the shelter act out. For example, clients might do something illegal for the sole purpose of being sent to jail.
Oh, yeah, that's a legitimate way for those folks to have some kind of security in their lives, and especially the ones who have been institutionalized and don't see opportunities for themselves in the real world.
It's not a good option for the community or for those experiencing homelessness, but he says people without homes are used to choosing between bad options. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Lex Trinan.
Still to come, it's Walter Harper Day, and a group wants to honor the first person to summit North America's highest peak.
People in the schools in Alaska can be taught about this amazing indigenous young man.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The special primary election for U.S. Representative is June 11th by mail, and an application is not needed. Ballots will start to be sent April 27th. Voters receive the same ballot regardless of political affiliation, and all candidates are on the ballot. The top four vote-getters move on to the special general election. Ballots must be mailed, signed, and postmarked by June 11th. More at elections.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Division of Elections.
Firefighters today were working to contain wildfires that started west of Talkeetna after lightning in the area, including one that was near nine structures. The biggest of the three fires, the Kachatna Fire, was about 40 acres, according to the Alaska Division of Forestry. Two helicopter crews responded, dropping water to slow the spread. Two air tankers, one each from Fairbanks and Palmer, dropped retardant to help protect the structures, and members of a hotshot crew worked the fire until early this morning. Firefighters said the fire was mostly contained to the ground with some torching in spruce trees. Of the two other fires, one was less than 1 acre and placed in monitor status. Crews were expected at the second fire, estimated at 5 acres. Meanwhile, in western Alaska, another lightning-caused wildfire burning about 12 miles north of St. Mary's has scorched about 30,000 acres of tundra, according to the Alaska Fire Service. The East Fork Fire started May 31st and was originally burning in a limited management area in the Yukon Delta National Wildlife Refuge. That means wildfires there can be allowed to burn to benefit the natural habitat. That management plan changed, though, when smoke jumpers responded to protect a native allotment and a cabin. The Alaska Fire Service said the fire had not burned any structures as of this morning. Helicopters were based in St. Mary's to provide support and water bucket drops, and the fire service said a hotshot crew was headed to the area. King salmon fishing will no longer be allowed in the Kenai River this month. That's following an announcement from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game that it will be closing the early run fishery to anglers effective tomorrow, amid really low king salmon counts. KDLL's Sabine Pooks has more.
The fishery opened last Wednesday under catch and release restrictions. The department was hopeful that it could keep it that way. But Fish and Game Sport Fish Area Manager Colton Lipka says the run's been underperforming.
And then when numbers didn't improve through the weekend, we deemed it necessary to close the sport fishery.
That's a step the department takes when the run doesn't look like it will make its escapement goal. Those are the goalposts it sets for the run. And as of Monday, only 265 large king salmon had passed through the sonar, where the department takes its measurements. Last year, over 900 kings had passed through the sonar by that time. It's historically the time about a third of the run has already made it through.
These are some pretty low counts for this date. If we were going to be looking at something that was going to meet the goal, we would need a pretty significant bump in fish to come in.
He says that's not out of the question. Water conditions have been slightly abnormal so far this season, for example.
But as for now, what we're looking at, the closure is necessary to get every king that we can upstream to spawn.
He says this run so far is reminiscent of the 2020 king salmon run, which was late and small. The department closed the fishery that year as well, on June 10th. Fish and Game is also restricting the Kasiloff River king salmon fishery to no bait. Only hatchery-produced king salmon can be caught in that fishery.
What we do when we have to restrict the Kenai or close the Kenai, we anticipate that there will be anglers that will then redirect their efforts towards the Kasiloff. So anticipating that increase in effort, we will then need to restrict some of the actions on the Kasiloff so we don't put too much effort or harvest that direction.
He says that restriction is also necessary since one lagging king run is indicative that there might be others elsewhere. That's certainly true for runs across Cook Inlet, Lipka says, where the department is seeing most king runs lagging behind. The late Kenai King Run, which starts July 1st and is the more popular of the King Sport fisheries, is currently set to open under catch and release downstream of the Slycock Creek marker. Upstream of that marker, the fishery will remain closed. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
The U.S. Army Alaska is now the 11th Airborne Division. The renaming was formalized at ceremonies held Monday at Fort Wainwright and Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. And as KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, it reflects a new focus on Arctic fighting tactics and equipment.
Monday morning ceremony at Fort Wainwright began with helicopters, as all airborne events must, including a half dozen carrying Army brass and dignitaries invited to the event.
You know, I love the sound of helicopters in the morning because it sounds like victory, and that's what this division is about. It's about victory.
Army Chief of Staff James McConville was on hand to officiate in the ceremony. The four-star observed it was being held on the anniversary of D-Day, when U.S. and Allied forces stormed the beaches of Europe 78 years ago to liberate the continent from the Nazis.
And on this June 6th, we're also making history. We are passing you the colors in the patch of the storied 11th Airborne Division.
McConville noted the 11th Airborne wasn't fighting in Europe at the time, but he says it developed tactics in the Asian theater that made airborne assault a critical element of the D-Day invasion. Former U.S. Army Alaska Commander Major General Brian Eifler, who now commands the division, says it'll be building on that expertise, both in Asia and the Arctic.
Our mission is to deter the threats and be ready to operate, fight, and win, both in Indo-Pacific and in the Arctic. And yes, that's a unique and difficult mission.
The 11th Airborne will be the Army's second based in the United States, the first being the 82nd Airborne out of Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Eifler says activating the new division will enable the Army to organize the 12,000 Alaska-based soldiers who've been pulled in many directions over the years and focus their mission on the Arctic and Indo-Pacific.
We were a brigade, we had an airborne battalion, and it was, you know, it was going to go away, and then we had the strikers, and then we were deploying to Iraq. You know, all over the years, we were all over the place.
Eifler said in a news conference before Monday's ceremony that military leaders realized that all those conflicting missions diminished U.S. Army Alaska's capabilities. He said that and an evolving geopolitical landscape driven by increased interest in the Arctic convinced leadership to make some changes.
We sort of lost the Arctic ethos that we had, you know, being an Arctic force and cold weather capable, because we are all focused on Afghanistan and Iraq.
Eifler said in a recent interview that the Army will continue reorganizing the 11th Airborne. He says initially the public may not notice much more than a new patch on soldiers' sleeves. But he says many of those changes will be related to a much greater focus on soldier mobility, on foot, on skis, or on new equipment like smaller snow-capable tracked vehicles. And he says the iconic multi-wheeled vehicles that the Fort Wainwright-based Stryker Brigade uses likely will be eventually phased out.
Probably see a lot less Strykers, maybe a little bit more airborne operations up here, because again, the only Arctic airborne capability is in this unit.
McConville and Eifler both said the 11th Airborne will begin hosting big training exercises like those conducted on ranges around Fort Irwin, California and Fort Rucker, Alabama. And they expect more training with soldiers from allied nations that want their troops to gain experience in operating in cold weather and mountainous terrain. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The IBEW is the union of skilled hands and generous hearts, hardworking people on the job and off. It's the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, the IBEW. This message sponsored by the IBEW Local 1547.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
When the Kenai City Council held off on accepting a grant for the Kenai Library last fall, spurring cries of censorship, residents opened their wallets and donated over $15,000. Librarian Katja Wolf says she and the library's fundraising arm will request funds from that $15,000 pool periodically when there's a part of the library's collection that needs some extra love. She says that chance doesn't come along often.
This is kind of a once in a career opportunity. So,
the GoFundMe campaign for the library was in response to a decision by the city council to turn down a grant from the National Library of Medicine last fall. The funding was aimed at revamping library collections that focused on health equity. Some council members said they worried about what strings would be attached to money from the feds and asked Wolf to send them a list of the materials she planned to buy. Some community members alleged censorship, and eventually the council backed down and accepted the federal funds, totaling $1,500. But two Kenai residents started a fundraiser that brought in more than 10 times that amount. Wolf says she's been working with the Friends of the Kenai Community Library to determine where the money might go. She says the library is in the process of withdrawing its first request of about $3,000.
It's really exciting to have those funds available to work on projects that we might not otherwise be able to work on. So I am so grateful to the community that they, you know, that they gave us this money, and we'll make sure we spend it wisely.
Once the library decides how it's going to spend the funds, it still needs to go back to the Kenai City Council for approval. Today is Walter Harper Day. The Alaska commemoration was passed into legislation in April 2020. A citizens' committee is preparing the installation of a monument in Fairbanks to honor the mountaineer and guide who was the first person to summit Denali. KUAC's Robin reports.
Walter Harper was only 20 years old when he became the first person to stand atop Denali on June 7, 1913. He wasn't the leader of the expedition, but he was the one who led the final distance of the climb.
We are so happy that there is recognition for Walter Harper, who was really, I think, the most valuable member of the four-member team that made the climb.
That's Harper's great-grandnephew, Mike Harper. He says Walter Harper was already known as a Koyukon Athabascan guide, an outdoorsman, and a dog driver when he joined Hudson Stuck, Harry Karstens, and Robert Tatum, the ascent team, and teenagers Johnny Fredson and Isaias George, who helped supply the expedition. Now a bronze monument will be installed at Doyon Place on the bank of the Chena River. It will celebrate Walter Harper, but also the expedition, which started at St. Matthew's Episcopal Church in what is now downtown Fairbanks and took 3 months. Bill Gordon is on the Walter Harper Project Committee. He says the 13-foot piece will arrive in Fairbanks in July. The committee has secured an in-kind contribution from Linden Transport to bring it up.
It's being created right outside of Salt Lake City, where it's being put together, and then it'll be taken over by truck to Seattle to be put on a boat and brought up to Fairbanks.
The statue of Harper shows him on the face of Denali with an ice axe in one hand and the other hand stretched out to help the next person up. Mike Harper says that hand, reaching out, will be an interactive part of the monument to help any visitor feel uplifted.
We're actually having the likeness made so that he appears to have his hand down, reaching down to help people up the mountain or wherever they might be. He is trying to help whoever it might be.
A bronze dog and 6 interpretive panels will complete the display. The statue is by artist Gary Lee Price, who did a sculpture of playing children in front of Denali School in Fairbanks. The committee is made of historians, family members, and friends, and has been working on getting the statue installed since the centennial of the first climb in 2013. The committee has a website, walterharper.org, and is taking donations there.
The statue itself is fully paid for. There's enough money for us to get the site built, but we want to do more with this because it's not only an inspirational site, but it is an educational site, and we're hoping to develop a curriculum.
Gordon says the committee wants to develop materials to help teachers convey the true history of what Harper did for Alaska.
We recognize William Seward, we recognize Captain Cook, we recognize Vitus Bering, and we recognize all kinds of explorers who came to Alaska to make it what it was. But this young man was a remarkable person. People in the schools in Alaska can be taught about this amazing Indigenous young man.
The monument will be unveiled on July 19. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Lex Trinan in Anchorage, Sabine Pooks in Kenai, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, and Robin in Fairbanks. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby. Katie Anastas is our producer. And I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
People who smoke or have smoking-related conditions like lung and heart disease are more likely to get seriously ill from COVID-19. Not using any tobacco or e-cigarette products is one of the best ways to keep your immune system strong, ready to fight all kinds of viruses. If you decide to quit, help is available. Call Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or text READY to 200-400 to get the support you need to quit for good. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.